keeping it a secret.
Well, Bob gave us the answer on that, I think.
Wonder if I can get the same answer twice. He's carrying all that money, and he didn't want to stop it all over the town, so he might get robbed.
No. That was sort of what Bob said last week, but it's a little bit different, but kind of the same. No, we're never going to get that answer for sure. We're looking for something good that might have happened from his coming there. So we could say, well, you know, maybe it wasn't all that bad a decision because look at the good stuff that came from that. And by the way, I lied through my teeth to you. I need to correct that. The good thing that happened to it was that he was only in Roman custody 5 years, and I told you 6 last week because I didn't remember right. But it's 5 years that he was in Roman custody as a result of his coming into Jerusalem. I'll talk you through that again this morning as we go through this. So it's hard to come up with a good explanation that says, well, yeah, I'm sure glad he went in there because look at what happened as a result of that. You can come up and say, geez, I wish he hadn't have done that because look at what happened as a result of that, you know, 5 years in Roman captivity. So we'll never get the answer. I lean toward the fact that surely he could have done something more and better as a free man for 5 years than in custody for 5 years. Could not he? People say, well, we wouldn't have had those prison epistles. Well, you can write those books from somewhere other than prison. You don't have to be in jail to write to Ephesians. So that don't make sense.
I still think it was part of his behavior, too, because he didn't seem to accept.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what I was
the Lord. Even
yeah,
the Lord.
There, he seems a bit a little, what shall we say, bullheaded about getting there with all that warning that he got.
At least in part.
And his past statement from God saying, don't go there, you know, get out of here, they're not going to believe you here. There seemed to be enough emphasis about not going that it's hard to figure out why he was so insistent on going. Anybody got a good idea?
Well, I have a question. So if the Romans came in to sort of swoop him out of the mess because people were getting ready to stone him, so why did they take him back to Rome and lock him up for 5 years? What was their reason that he had to be locked up?
We're going to see that develop.
Okay.
He's going to be 2 years in Caesarea, which is the capital of this area. See, the Romans captured him in Jerusalem from this mob action, and because of that plot to kill him, they thought it would be better to take him up to Caesarea, kind of the headquarters. So they do. So when we left off last week, he's up here in Caesarea, waiting to have these charges that this mob was leveling against him presented in a semi-proper court of law, and that will take place over a 2-year period. We'll see that and why it takes so long. Then, and something happens that makes him claim his right to be tried in Rome, because he's a Roman citizen, and he sees that he ain't going to get a decent trial here. So when he makes that claim, he's destined for Rome. And then it takes him 9 months to get there because of a storm we'll work our way through as well. So he spends 2 years here and has several hearings, and we'll see those. Then he spends 9 months trying to get to Rome. Excuse me. Yeah, 9 months to get to Rome. And then he's in jail there 2 more years to try to have his case heard. So there's 5 years of legal proceedings and confinement that he faces because he went back to Jerusalem on that third journey instead of going on to Rome or wherever he wanted to go. Yeah, Sheila.
Well, why did he go back to the old covenant? That was what I was concerned about.
That's a good question.
Because we don't know that either.
Yeah, no. He is about to get in a position where he's going to make an animal sacrifice to conclude that old covenant. And that's part of the complication of all this mess.
And you'd think they'd be pleased because he was going back to the old covenant and not put him in jail.
Yeah, yeah.
Or prison.
That's right. That just complicates things to think, well, why is Paul trying to fulfill this vow by completing this ritual sacrifice under the old Mosaic law? You know, we know he's trying to be all things to all people, but there is a limit to that, and that might be that limit there. Yeah, Father.
Well, it just dawned on me why.
Well, tell the rest of us then.
Well, you know, all things work for good, the glory of the Lord.
Yeah.
Well, he needed to be able to declare that he was a Roman citizen to get protection of it, so he got a free trip to Rome that way.
Oh, it's a free trip he's after. Well, that makes a little economic sense.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he'd have bought the ticket himself, wouldn't he?
Well, that's the economic situation. He was carrying all that money back.
Yeah, yeah. And we talked about that a little bit, too. That's another complicating fact, is that Luke doesn't make anything out of that at all. I mean, if that's Paul's primary motive for going back there, carrying that money back there to him, Luke blows it off. He says, yeah, they gave him the money and we went on and did some stuff. It's hard to see that that would be a overriding thought for Paul in light of all the warnings he got, because the money, the gift, the donation to the poor in the Church of Jerusalem just kind of seems to turn to dust in Luke's accounting of it.
Well, could he have gotten to Rome without being declaring himself a Roman citizen and demanding?
Oh, sure. See, when he was a free man, he'd just buy a ticket and sail over there if he wanted to. Just anybody can travel to Rome if they wanted to. He didn't have to have a Roman escort the whole way. So that's why you can't say, well, the consequences of him going to Rome are good. That's why he should have gone there. Well, he went there as a prisoner.
That's the way God wanted it, so that's the way it was.
It's the way God worked it out, that's for sure. Now, did he have to do that? Could Paul not have just gotten to Rome and served the Lord in the same capacity as a free man? We're never going to get these answers, are we? We're going to always wonder, Paul, what in the heck drove you so hard to Jerusalem that caused you then to be confined for 5 years? We won't know. But let's go on and look at the development of how this all came about. We'll see this in these next several chapters. We'll see how it is it came about that he got to Rome in the legal system. All right, when we left off last week, he was up in Caesarea under Roman confinement. And in verse 1 of chapter 24, after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders with a certain attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. So the Jews sent up an entourage from Jerusalem up to Caesarea. They got him a hired mouthpiece, a lawyer, and they presented charges against Paul up there in Caesarea. All of this is legally okay. I mean, this is the way the system worked. So that's happening. So his first trial, following his being taken captive in Jerusalem, is up there in Caesarea before the current Roman governor, Felix. So after Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Hey, since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix." We're lathering you up, Felix, if you don't happen to recognize it, "with all thankfulness. But that I may not worry you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing. For we have found this man, Paul, one, he's a real pest." That's his first charge, he's a pest. Wow, that's heavy. He ought to be executed for being a pest, shouldn't he? Second charge is, he stirs up dissension. Well, that's part of the first charge. He's a pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. Secondly, he is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He's a heretic. He's teaching things that are heresy to our nation. A ringleader of the sect of the Nazarene. And thirdly, and he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him. And then you see a big square bracket there in verse 6. Remember what that means? That's not in the best manuscripts. May be true. It says, and we wanted to judge him according to our own law. Yeah, they were trying to kill him. That was a judgment. But Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hands. We were just simply innocent, law-abiding citizens, and this mean old Roman commander took him out of our hands. That's a little bit of a spin on the truth, isn't it? Ordering his accusers to come before you. And by examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you'll be able to ascertain the things which we accuse him. And the Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so. So he's been accused of three things. He's a seditionist. He's a heretic. And sacrilege against the Jewish state. So, that's his charges. In verse 10, and when the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded. So, Paul gets to speak for himself. And he says, verse 10, knowing that for many years you've been a judge of this nation, I cheerfully make my defense, since you can take note of the fact. Now, this guy Felix, this governor, he knows the Jewish people, and he knows their laws and their rules and all that stuff. So, he is a guy who can make good discernments between the accusations against Paul and his answers in defense. So he's a good guy and for understanding these things. So he says, you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. So if he's a seditionist, how is it that he manages to become so effective and so capable in 12 whole days? Most of the time, you need a little time to whip up some people and cause seditions and things of this, but he's been in custody 6 out of the 12 days that he is referring to, so he's only been on the street 6 days. And they're accusing him of being this great seditionist in a whole 6-day span. And neither in the temple nor in the synagogues nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Hey, I didn't do anything. I didn't stir any pots. I was only there 6 days. Nor can they prove to you the charges which they now accuse me. So there's no proof of his causing riots and disturbances of the public and all this sort of stuff. So that's his defense against his first charge. Secondly, this charge of heresy. He says, but this I admit to you, that according to the way, or according to Christendom, if we want to call it that, it's the same thing, it's just a different name for the same thing. But according to this way, according to Christianity, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience, both before God and before men. So his ringleader of the Nazarenes that they accuse him about, this heresy that they accuse him of, he said, look, I'm just following Jewish law and all that sort of thing. There's no real heresy against Judaism or anything of that going on. And thirdly, as far as the sacrilege goes against the temple, he says, now after several days I came to bring alms to my nation and present my offerings. And I got a note in my Bible that says, why? Same question we've been asking over and over again. Why was he doing that there? In which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd or uproar. So I was just doing my Jewish thing in the temple, not causing any problems or stirring any pots. But there were these Jews from Asia. This is not Asia where they are here. This is Caesarea. There's these Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you and to make accusation if they should have anything against me. Where are these guys from Asia that accuse me of this stuff? They're not even here. Or else let these men themselves tell you what misdeed they found that when I stood before the council, other than for this one statement which I shouted out while standing among them for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today. So he does admit that he brought up the fact that the Pharisees believed in the resurrection and the Sadducees did not. And so he divided and conquered that council meeting, quite well by raising this point about resurrection. So Felix, the governor, having a more exact knowledge about the way, or Christianity, put them off, saying, "When Lysias the commander comes down, I will decide your case." So when the Roman commander, who saw this mob action, rescued you, Paul, and sent you up here, when he gets here, we'll talk about this some more, and I'll decide your case. And he gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody and yet to have some freedom and not prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. So what could have been a quick in and out for this trial turns out to delay a while because Felix, the governor, does not make a decision based upon what little he's heard. He wants to hear from the Roman commander, Lysias. So he just tells Paul, "I'm going to keep you in custody for a little bit." Wasn't the worst form of custody he's ever experienced. It's sort of like a house arrest type thing. People can come and go and minister to him and things like that. So he doesn't take any action. He makes no decision. His primary duty as governor is to administrate justice to the citizenry, and he just kind of wimps out, blows him off. No decision. So what could have been maybe a several-day custody, a couple of weeks maybe, is lingering now. Now, some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. So this guy actually wants to hear a little bit from Paul, and Paul witnesses to him. And as Paul, was discussing righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, "Go away for the present, and when I find some time, I will summon you." Now, Drusilla, his wife, was an incestuous relationship. And so when Paul starts speaking to this guy in private, not as part of his trial, but in private, about righteousness and self-control and judgment to come, Felix, he gets frightened. He realizes that he is on the receiving end of the judgment to come here, and so he just pushed Paul off again and tells him, "Well, whenever I get some time, Paul, we'll talk some more." And another motive for his unwillingness to go ahead and make a decision is he was trying to work a bribe out of Paul. Look at the next verse, verse 26. "At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given to him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him." So instead of deciding his case like he should have, he just keeps it dangling out there, going on and on and on. He talks to Paul every now and then in hopes that Paul will slip something between the two of them and bribe the guy off. He's just another classic corrupt politician. One of the most objectionable people we observe in our society are corrupt politicians, guys who pervert justice to line their own pockets. They're despicable human beings, and the day is going to come when they're going to be held accountable for this, and this guy is just a classic one of them. He ain't going to decide this case. He thinks there's some money in it for him. He's a rat, is all he is. And 2 years go by. You were asking earlier, why does this thing take so long? It's because this corrupt politician won't do his job and wants to try to make some money. He just keeps Paul dangling out there and doesn't decide his case for 2 years. Now, I don't know if the church there in Caesarea, remember the Roman centurion Cornelius, where the dogs were let in, where Peter had taught them about a day of Pentecost for the Gentiles. You'd think maybe the church could have helped out a little bit there and got a lawyer in there or somebody to press this case. Paul doesn't seem to be getting any help from anybody. If he is, it's not clear. It's not obvious from the text. How does this thing dangle for 2 years? Well, if he is sort of by himself, if he is not being supported and helped by the local Christian community, and this guy Felix is bound and determined to get him a bribe. That's how. So 2 years transpire, and the guy is still just sitting in a jail cell in Caesarea. Okay? There's the first 2 years of his 5-year Roman confinement spent right there waiting for these good-for-nothing, worthless politicians to make a decision, which they won't do. And after the 2 years go by, his replacement comes on the scene. His name is Porcius Festus. So Felix is replaced by Festus for the rest of us. And wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. So the new guy comes on the scene. The new governor comes on the scene. The old governor just leaves Paul dangling in there because the Jews wanted him to, and he's just accommodating the Jews, and so he leaves Paul there. So now, after 2 years, the whole process, in effect, starts over again with a new governor. The old one was an absolute miserable failure in doing his duty, and now we got a new guy on the scene. The old guy knew Jewish law and Jewish heritage and Jewish society well. The new guy doesn't. But Paul's just left there, dangling after 2 years. So Festus, therefore, new governor, having arrived in the province 3 days later, went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. So he goes up to Jerusalem to meet the leading Jews because his job is to govern this area here, and these guys, the Jews in Jerusalem, are the prime drivers of all of that. So he's going up to meet his main problem area, the people that he has to keep in line and pleased and functioning peacefully and all that sort of thing. In other words, the people that can influence him the best. And the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him, requesting a concession against Paul, that he might have him brought to Jerusalem, at the same time setting an ambush to kill him on the way. So Festus goes up to Jerusalem, and they come up with a scheme that says, hey, bring Paul back down here to us, and we want to present our case against him. So bring him back down here. And they're going to try to nail him on the way. They got an ambush set up to kill him on the way. Remember the 40 guys that weren't going to eat until they'd killed Paul? Well, it's 2 years later, so they're probably pretty thin by now. But now there's another plot laid to kill Paul, and they want him brought back down to Jerusalem after the 2-year confinement up in Caesarea. So Festus then answered and said Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea and that he himself was about to leave shortly. Therefore, he said, let any influential men among you go there with me, and if there's anything wrong about the man, let them prosecute him. So he says, no, you guys, I'm heading up to Caesarea. You can come with me. Get your team together and bring them up here, and we'll prosecute the guy up there in Caesarea where he is and has been for the past 2 years. The wheels of justice ain't exactly spinning rapidly here, are they? Verse 6, after he spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea, and on the next day he took his seat at the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. And after he had arrived, the Jews who had come down with him from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. Well, you remember when Felix was the governor, they presented 3 charges against Paul. He knew their stuff. The new guy doesn't. So when the new guy gets there, they just start throwing everything they can think of against Paul. All kinds of charges, many and serious charges, and they couldn't prove any of them. So they're trying to smoke this new guy because he doesn't know enough to know what they're talking about. And Paul said on his own defense, I've committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. So all of his 3 charges which were presented before, Paul says, I haven't done any of that stuff. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, there's your corrupt politician again, taking care of his cronies. He says, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? So he, Festus, is pressing to take Paul back to Jerusalem, where the plot has been laid to try to kill him on the way. But Paul says, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. I've done no wrong to the Jews, as you also know very well. In other words, everything is perfectly fine and legal right here. Why are you wanting to change the venue? If then I'm a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of these things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. And there is the next 3 years. That appeal, which Paul has to make, because he knows he's not going to get a fair trial here, he has a right as a Roman citizen to have his case heard by Caesar in Rome. And so he has to make that appeal to keep from being dragged back down to Jerusalem and probably killed on the way. So there's your 5 years. 2 years of nothing happening here, which should have. An appeal to Caesar, which takes a boat ride, and some more time, which will transpire up there in Rome. And it turns out that the whole thing is a little under 5 years. Yeah, Bob.
If he had gone through this process, he wouldn't have been able to appear before Caesar, the Supreme Court. That's pretty good advertising.
Hmm. Well,
you get before the Supreme Court, you get a lot of coverage.
Well, it's true. By getting caught up in the Roman judicial system, he does then have the basis for an appeal to Rome. If he hadn't been arrested in the first place, he could have gone to Rome. He just wouldn't have been in Caesar's court.
High profile if he'd gone there.
Yeah. You could argue that point and say, well, the good that came out of all this is that he got in Caesar's face. I mean, was it worth 5 years? Because who cares about Caesar? He's trying to evangelize Rome, the city.
Well, that gets the attention of the entire Roman Empire. That's worth a lot.
It's worth something. That's right. And it would have taken some sort of a legal proceeding, as we're witnessing here, to get him in that particular strata of Roman society, the legal part of it. Yes, that's true. Is that worth 5 years of your life? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, what else you got to do, Paul?
He wouldn't go where he was going to go anyway.
So, but that is a valid observation, Bob. That he is now in a strata of Roman society that he probably could not have penetrated before with just street corner gospel teaching and so on. You're right about that. So, there's how it all came about to get to 5 years. 2 years in Caesarea, nothing happening because of corrupt politicians. An appeal to Caesar, which means he's got to get to Rome, so there's some travel time to get to Rome, and then his case there will last, we'll see as we complete the book, it'll take another 2 years there. So that's your 5 years that I said was six last week. It's actually five. All right, so having made that appeal, verse 11 of 25, Verse 12, then when Festus had conferred with his council and answered, you have appealed to Caesar you shall go. They have no choice. When Paul made that appeal as a Roman citizen, that was his right. And so he's locked the next, he doesn't know it's going to be 3 years. He might think it's just the boat ride and then maybe a few months or something like that. But he's locked that next series of events down with that appeal. So, the die is cast. Paul is going to Rome. We know he wanted to get to Rome. I don't know that he wanted to get there in chains or had to get there in chains. His appeal was he wanted to get to the church in Rome. He wanted to teach and preach to the believers there and to everybody in Rome, not to the legal system that has him captured. But that's the way he's going to go. All right, so he's now, in effect, secured passage to Rome. in charge of the Roman army. So now when several days has elapsed, here's a third character that comes on the scene. This is King Agrippa. And Bernice, his sister, show up. They're, he's actually the king of Perea, which is over on the east side of the Jordan. But he's come over to meet the new governor of his neighbor, Palestine. And so he's there now. And Festus talks to him about Paul's case and says, hey, there's a certain man left in prison by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and elders of the Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation upon him. Of course, they want him dead. That's, they always want opposition dead. Ask Stephen. And I answered them that it's not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accusers face to face and he has opportunity to make his defense against him. So after they had assembled there, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat at the tribunal and ordered a man to be brought. And when the accuser stood up and began bringing charges against him, not of such crimes as I was expecting. In other words, they weren't against the Roman state, which he was expecting. These are Jewish crimes that they were accusing Paul of. But they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion and about a certain dead man, Jesus, whom Paul asserted to be alive. So he said, you know, this guy, he's kind of a puzzlement to me. I thought he'd done something against the Roman state. But when the Jews, these people that they're trying to govern peacefully here, stood up and made their accusations, it was just about their own stuff. And being at a loss how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, order him to be kept in custody until I can send him to Caesar. In other words, when Paul made that appeal, this guy's hands were tied. And so Agrippa, this neighboring king, this is the last of the Herods. The Herodian dynasty ends with this guy. The Herods were kings of Palestine that the Romans placed in charge as their puppet leaders. They had their own governors, but they had this Jewish king who would oversee their affairs also, and they would give him some prerogatives and some rights and so on. And his family were in charge of a number of the countries over there for a little while, and he's the last one of them. So he's the last of these. This would be Herod the Great's grandson. So on the next day, when Agrippa had come together with Bernice amid great pomp and had entered the auditorium accompanied by the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, well, King Agrippa and all you gentlemen here present with us, you behold this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not to live any longer. Yeah, he was a pest. We need to kill this guy. But I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death. And since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. Yet I have nothing definite about him to write to my lord. Therefore, I have brought him before you and all, especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation is taking place, I may have something to write. In other words, I need you guys' help in putting together a story on this guy. So when I send him to Caesar, there needs to be a reason that we send him to Caesar. And I don't quite understand all that's going on here. And I could use your help in putting it together, because it seemed absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him. Well, you can write about that. I imagine Caesar would have had this guy's head if he got a prisoner sent to him and didn't even have a record of what the charges were. So Paul is allowed to speak then to this King Agrippa. It's not going to be a trial per se, because he's already been granted a appeal to Caesar. So he can't change that now. But nevertheless, what he does is he recounts his conversion in chapter 26. And we don't need to read every word of it. It's the same things we've seen before. There's three accountings of his conversion here. And I'll just let you read down through there and see for yourself. But it's the same stuff we've seen before. And it concludes with this conclusion from Agrippa, he said to Festus, well, this, verse 32, this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So he concludes, well, geez, I don't see anything about this guy that's worthy of a trial or anything else. If he hadn't made this appeal, we could have set him free. Again, we're looking for these little tidbits of insight as to Paul's thinking. Well, he could have gone as a free man. Now, something could have happened that got him over there just as well. But in this particular case, he's going as a not free man. All right? So, the die is cast. He's going to Rome. He's just got to get there. And what happens in chapter 27 is how he gets there. And chapter 27 is the detail about this trip that you see lined out here in purple on this particular map. Now, several commentators ask the question, why does Luke spend as much time and detail accounting for this journey as he does? After all, it's just a boat ride. It's just getting there. And there's all kinds of guesses as to what the answer to that question is. I've got mine. So this is one that it is not, but I'll mention it to you anyway. This boat ride, I think, in the mind of Luke, is in essence a metaphor for life. Life's a journey, right? You start out someplace and you end up someplace, and there's a journey from one extreme to the other, from one end to the other. Life is a journey, and the various characteristics of this boat ride, this journey, are kind of typical for living the Christian life. And any life, any journey through life will be met at times with storms of life, won't they? Everything always smooth and easy going through life. What planet are you living on? Now, it's very typical. The difficulties and stresses of this journey are very typical of the difficulties and stresses of life that we encounter. And so I think Luke probably sees this thing as a picture, a metaphor of the Christian life. We'll see a Christian man and how he handles the storms and the difficulties, and we'll see non-Christian people and how they handle the storms and difficulties. And it's just a little microcosm of life, I think, is why he includes this detail. There's probably other reasons as well, but I think he wants us to kind of see the lessons that are pictured in this boat journey as being lessons for our lives. That's what one fool thinks anyway. And so that's what we're going to see. And we can probably start the journey, I guess, before we hook them here this morning. So, to Rome. When it was decided that we should sail for Italy, who's with Paul here? Our author, Luke. He apparently stays with Paul through his imprisonment in Rome. He's apparently with him for the next 3 years. And there's a few other people who apparently are traveling with him. So this journey is not completely alone. His second imprisonment, it looks like he is more or less abandoned by the believers in Rome. And I'll show you reasons for thinking that as we go through this. But here, Luke is with him. So we're going to sail for Italy. And they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And Julius, this centurion, and by the way, you ever notice in Scripture how the centurions, Roman centurions, all turn out to be good guys? They're good guys. I doubt that they all are, judging from the way they treated our Savior during the Passion Week, but But most of the time, the accounting of the behavior of Roman centurions is admirable. This guy named Julius is in charge. This ship that they're going to take is actually a grain vessel that's part of the Roman fleet economy. He's in charge, not the captain of the boat. The Roman centurion is the guy in charge of this journey, even though normally it would be the ship's captain. He is in this case. So, Julius, you are the man. You got to get everybody there safe. They got some other prisoners they're taking as well. And embarking in an Adramesian ship that was down toward Egypt. Egypt was kind of the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. They grew most of the grain down there. And if you believe this MyPillow guy on TV, they got some good cotton up there in the Nile area too, don't they? And man, he managed to secure just enough of it to sell you some pillowcases if you want any. But this ship is from Egypt, and it's a grain-carrying vessel, and Julius is in charge of it. It was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia. We put out to sea accompanied by Aristarchus. This is another one of the guys that is with Paul, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. So Paul's got at least two buds we know about, Luke and Aristarchus. And the next day we put out at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and to receive care. What care did he need, I wonder? Maybe he got getting almost beat to a pulp by the mob there in Jerusalem. He might have still had some medical problems he needed a little help with. So they hop along the coast here from Caesarea up to Sidon, and Julius is treating Paul well. And maybe that's why Luke accompanied him. Maybe he had some medical problems. I mean, how many times can you get beat up in life and not have a few lingering medical problems, huh? Maybe Paul had some. Maybe Luke just went because he's his friend. I don't know. And from there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. Well, in the fall, sailing westward in the Mediterranean is difficult at best, and it ceases altogether in early November. You cannot go west on the Mediterranean in late fall. The winds are all contrary to you, and you can't get anywhere. So what they're trying to do is they're kind of hugging the coastline here and trying to get shelter from these islands and the land as best they can, and kind of work their way along the coast there to inch along. So when we'd sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. See where they're going here? Now obviously Luke is with them because he's got the detail down of every left-hand turn they're making and everything else. Okay, so they managed to make it up here to this city of Myra in southern Turkey today, Asia back then. And there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. So this guy has found a ship now that's going their way. He procures it and loads everybody onto that ship. And when we'd sailed slowly for a good many days, and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmon, and with difficulty, sailing past it, we came to a certain place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. So they're working their way along the coast, trying to make whatever progress they can down to here. Now, this Fair Havens is a good port. You could winter there if you wanted to. And so they've managed to get to that point. And it's getting, of course, late in the fall. And how to progress, how to proceed is not simply determined. And when considerable time had passed, verse 9, and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over. Paul began to admonish them. The fast would have been October 5 in that year, so they're getting down deep into the fall now. And they're continuing to want to make progress, but Paul recognizes, hey guys, it's getting a little late in the year here. He tells them in verse 10, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage, with great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." So Paul warns them, hey, let's don't try to get any further here. This is difficult. Danger is ahead. Sometimes in life we can see that, can't we? We can see some dangerous circumstances developing ahead of us. Sometimes we get an indication from God that it's better to hunker down where you are than to try to keep proceeding onward. So it's been a difficult journey. They're sailing against the prevailing winds. There are forces against them the whole way. And Paul has a warning for them. God has sent a warning through Paul to not try to go any further. And so we will not go any further this morning. We'll pick this journey up next week. So far they've just done this stuff here. And it's been kind of difficult, but doable. Nothing is clear sailing. Nothing is easy. It's been work. It's like life is, isn't it? And there's times when recognizing warnings, it's time to hunker down. And Paul suggested that. But they ain't going to pay attention to him, as we'll see next week. So any questions about anything we've seen here this morning so far? Now, you see how the five-year develops? 2 years of corrupt politicians not doing their job in Caesarea. Paul ultimately making an appeal to Caesar, which requires this journey, and he doesn't know it yet, but it'll take 2 more years after he's there. So that's where the 5 years come from.
In the middle in bad weather, he's
going to
wish he was in jail.
You're right about that. The attitude of the people on this boat will change drastically before they get there. But we'll see how Paul's attitude is, how he manages it. Any question? Yeah, Joyce.
The place in Harvey where they had that big earthquake, 28,000 people were killed.
That was up in Syria and Turkey. I gather it's kind of right in through here, Joyce. I don't know exactly, but Syria and Turkey, it got a whole bunch. I think the worst was in Turkey, wasn't it? And Syria was a smaller amount of death, but total over 20,000 last I saw. May even be higher now. See, there is a, I don't know if you know this or not, but Jerusalem sits on a fault line. The African plate and the Arabian plate butt against one another right here. And there is a fault line right through Jerusalem, right up here. And so that fault line may be where this earthquake took place. Those plates try to turn against each other all the time, and occasionally they turn loose a little bit. You know, the world gets these events from time to time from God, I think, as a warning, but usually they're ignored. We get accustomed to them. We get accustomed to accepting huge deaths and disasters. And when the tribulation period events start to take place and we get some really, really, really bad disasters, people are sort of accustomed to accept it. They don't see it as God's judgmental hand. They just think, we've had earthquakes before. So it's 100,000 instead of 20,000. Big deal. And people ignore these judgmental warnings from God as being essentially nothing, when in reality they are forewarnings of his return. So this may be something like that, where people will just get used to it, kind of accept that 20,000 is no big deal. And we don't always learn our lessons the best from these things, do we? Any other questions or comments? Well, you're going to watch the big game today?
The commercials.
Yeah. That's the only entertaining part, isn't it? I think 30-second deals, how many millions are they having to pay for 30 seconds this year? Did anybody see?
I thought I heard on the radio somewhere that they're going to have a commercial about Jesus. It's going to be something, a testimony about Jesus. I thought, I sure want to see that.
There has been some commercial campaigns going on where it's showing different scenes of different types of people, like if you're on the Broadway street or whatever. The tagline is Jesus gets us, or Jesus was